Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Of course, one of the great challenges in that war at the moment is Vladimir Putin's Russia. And I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Leon Aron. He is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he directs its Russian Studies program. He is also a member of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, the author of numerous very important books, including Yeltsin, A Revolutionary Life, Russia's Revolution, a collection of essays, and most recently, Road to the Temple, Memory, Ideas, and Ideals in the Making of the Russian Revolution. Leon Aron, welcome back. It's good to have you, my friend.
Good to be here, Frank.
You have been following with great attention and care, I think, the various permutations of the Putin regime, first as president of Russia, then as the prime minister of Russia, then as the president of Russia again. Tell us what to make at this moment in time as we're going into a new era in perhaps Russian-U.S. relations with the Trump presidency. What should Donald Trump know about Vladimir Putin that he might not?
I think there's only one most important thing to keep in mind about Putin. He's not a pragmatist. He's not a deal maker. He's a man on a self-imposed historical mission to avenge the fall of the Soviet Union, to restore Russia to the lost glory of the Soviet Union, and to become the preponderant world power undermining the West and the United States.
Not a man we could do business with, in short. The question there of the restoration of Russia to the glories of the Soviet Union sort of suggests perhaps the restoration of the Soviet Union as well. Do you see his ambition extending to that as well, Leon?
Well, it's a little different. He is not silly. He knows that he does not have to take, say, on the stands in Central Asia. They're a drain on the economy. Plus, that brings him to the direct contact with Taliban, something that still may happen, but he certainly is not eager to do it now. He doesn't want to take on the burdens of feeding and supporting economically the lesser brothers, as it were, of the former Soviet republics. What he wants to do, though, is he wants to have a total control over, certainly over foreign and defense orientations of the post-Soviet states. And in some cases, in the cases of the countries that are symbolically very important, that is historically, ethnically, culturally, such as Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus, he wants to have control over their domestic politics as well. Because if they ever establish themselves as a more or less sustainable democracies, that's a huge threat to his regime.
Well said. This is not, it would appear, the view that Donald Trump has taken of Vladimir Putin. He has made it very clear he aspires to a better relationship. You've warned about being a useful idiot, a turn of phrase that harkens back, I believe, to Lenin's time. Talk a little bit about how you see this dynamic sorting itself, Leon. Is it likely that there will be a new and improved relationship, given what you've said? It doesn't sound all that
well. Frank, there are a couple of things here. You know, the relationship with the Soviet Union and Russia is sort of the secular equivalent of the Protestant zeal to Christianize China. You know, every American president, with the exception of Harry Truman, who kind of landed in the Cold War, was handed to him, started his relationship by trying to have a better relationship with either the Soviet Union or Russia. That's inevitable. I mean, look every single American president, starting with Roosevelt. So in that sense, I wouldn't say Trump is different. Where he is different, I think, is frankly in his lack of understanding of the regime. As I said, he thinks that Putin is a fellow deal maker, and he can do business with him. But remember this canonic quote from Margaret Thatcher, 1984, when the probably unknown to most secretary of the Central Committee by the name of Mikhail Gorbachev came to visit Britain. And again, it's a tribute to her incredible perspicacity and political instincts that she said, yes, we can do business with him, not because he's a secretary of the Communist Party, but because she expected things from him that came to pass. I remember Reagan, too. Contrary to all his advisors, he went to Moscow in 1988 because he felt that this man was genuine and he unleashed the revolution. Now, in the case of Trump, there is, I think, an enormously steep learning curve. Now, I'm open to this. I'm an agnostic on this. As he begins to learn about Putin's regime, as he begins to learn about its history, how he dealt with the opponents, what it's done inside the country, how it treated the former Soviet republics, perhaps he can curtail his enthusiasm for deal making. Now, there's nothing wrong with it going to summit, but only if it materially advances the U.S. interests. Again, Trump says he admires Ronald Reagan. Well, remember Reagan. He did not invite Gorbachev to the Washington until 1987 when they signed, you remember very well, we talked about this at the time, when Russia scrapped the entire category of nuclear missiles.
As it happens temporarily, it seems, based on what Putin is up to, and that was a matter of some concern for me at the time. But let me ask you, you've written recently about another factor at work inside Russia, namely something you've called the Russian Jihad. Talk a little bit about the demographic changes that are taking place and the challenge that Putin and his Russian population is up against in terms of the rising numbers and the increasing, it seems, aggressiveness of the Muslim population.
Well, just Frank, a few statistics. Russia is the largest Muslim country in Europe now, about 20 million Muslims practicing or not. And of course, 90% of them, 99% of them are fine, but you don't need many to create havoc, as we've seen. The Russian language is the second most popular language now of ISIS, apart from Arabic. It displaced English. At the Guantanamo, the only country that equaled Britain in the number of prisoners is Russia. If you start looking at the suicide bombers, they, particularly in Turkey, virtually all the recent ones came from Central Asia, where the lingua franca of the jihadist is Russian. Why? Because most of them are recruited as guest workers in Russia. There are between 4 and 6 million of barely documented or completely undocumented guest workers from the Muslim countries.
Yeah, including, as I understand it, large numbers of them in Moscow itself.
Yes, well, Moscow, again, to add to the gruesome statistics that I mentioned, Russia is emerged as the key hubbub of ISIS recruitment, probably in line with, say, London and Paris, and probably surpassing them by now.
Let me ask you very quickly, and I've got less than a minute, Leon Aaron. Do you believe that a shared concern about these, I call them Sharia supremacists, for want of a better term, is a basis for some kind of modus vivendi between Putin and the United States?
Well, it is in the interest of the United States to try to suppress the Russian jihad as the new hotbed of jihadism, where Trump is, I think, completely wrong, at least as far as the record has been until now, is to try and gauge Russia's help in Syria. Obama, rather pathetically, and Kerry even more pathetically, try to have Russia do what the U.S. wanted them to do in Syria with obvious results. I wrote in one of my articles that Putin played
chess in Syria, and we played tic-tac-toes.
Yeah, not even checkers. Leon Aaron, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We'll be back to you for more, including on the at the Broadcasting Board of Governors, on which you serve, and the work that it's about, which I think is taking on ever greater importance. Leon, thank you so much for all you do for our country at the American Enterprise Institute, and for joining us. I hope you'll do so again very soon. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. We'll talk with him about Trump easing sanctions on the Russians and their intelligence service. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, man we have the privilege of talking with just about every week at this time, one of the country's preeminent national security reporters. He has worked with great distinction for years with the Washington Times, where he has a prize-winning column called Inside the Ring. He is also a senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon and the author of now 7 best-selling books, including the most recent, the highly acclaimed I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us, sir.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the show.
Bill, in the information warfare space, of course, one issue that you've been covering closely and that has been of considerable controversy, of course, is the role that the Russians have been playing in cyber attacks. They finally got Barack Obama's attention on his way out the door by going after the Democratic Party and John Podesta, which prompted him to impose some sanctions against the FSB, the Russian Intelligence Service. I was talking earlier in the program with Leon Aaron about the relationship with the Russians. There seems to be some movement on that front. Talk a little bit about what you found at the Treasury Department.
Well, the Treasury Department announced this week that they were loosening sanctions on the FSB, which is the Federal Security Service. They billed it as basically a technical adjustment, but there's no getting around the perception that they've made a concession to the Russians. And, of course, the former head of the FSB, a guy named Nikolayev, came out and said this was a great step towards U.S.-Russian counterterrorism cooperation. The story I did today in the Free Beacon on this is really a look at the FSB, which has emerged as kind of the new KGB, the Soviet-era political police and security service. And the FSB is doing a lot of bad stuff in the cyber and influence area. As I outline in I War, their department, although the GRU military intelligence has been doing a lot of the legwork on these operations, it's the FSB which has the power and authority to direct these operations.
So easing sanctions, even if it's mostly symbolic, is probably the wrong signal to be sending specifically to this security service and to the Kremlin more generally, I would guess.
Absolutely. The FSB is the legs upon which the Putin regime stands, just as the KGB was the sword and shield of the Soviet Union. The FSB is kind of the sword and shield of the Putin regime in Moscow. And it's important to keep pressure on them. And I think that, you know, we had these 2 intelligence reports which outlined the Russian cyber-enabled influence operation against the election, which, again, was not limited to Democrats. They got Colin Powell, and they earlier had gone after Philip Breedlove, the NATO commander. We really need to keep pressure on them. But these reports said that these Russian operations were continuing after the election. In other words, there's been no let-up. So even sanctioning them and expelling some 35 officers hasn't had much of an impact. It's clear that the U.S. needs to take off the gloves and go on the offensive against these outfits.
Yeah, this is, of course, an argument you make very persuasively and powerfully in your book, I War. Bill Gertz, let me turn to another topic that, again, I think you've done extraordinarily important work on for so long, Bill, and that is monitoring what the communist Chinese are up to with respect to particularly the modernization of their nuclear forces. Tell us about the new DF-5C missile and what it portends for us.
Yeah, this is a major story. Last month, the Chinese military conducted a flight test of this new ICBM variant, which had 10 warheads. This represents a significant increase in the nuclear capability of China. For decades, the intelligence community assessed that the Chinese nuclear arsenal was limited to about 250 warheads, most of them single warheads, large ones on missiles. Earlier last year, in around February, about a year ago, intelligence began detecting the uploading of the DF-5 missiles with from 1 to 3, and now they've tested one with 10. What this means is that the arsenal, which is thought to have been 250 warheads, could be orders of magnitude larger, and that has serious implications for U.S. deterrent calculations. We may need to upgrade all of our missiles, which we downloaded from multiple warheads, especially our land-based ones, and so this should really raise a debate about strategic deterrence.
Well, and Bill, I guess implicit in what you just said is the fact that we may need to rethink the whole idea of the kinds of reductions that we've made. If we have now seen perhaps a tenfold increase in the numbers of weapons in the Chinese arsenal, that would considerably exceed the number of weapons that we have deployed at the moment, would it not?
Right. And when you factor in the Russian nuclear forces, which have increased under the New START treaty from 2010, while the U.S. has drastically cut its nuclear forces, there is a major strategic imbalance emerging. And like I say, you, more than anyone, having been in the Pentagon, understand the importance of maintaining a strategic nuclear deterrence. And not only is it a numbers issue, it's also a modernization issue. We need to upgrade to newer, more modern, safer, and more effective weapons. And hopefully, President Trump has said that that's going to be one of the highest priorities of his administration. I hope he follows through on it.
Yeah, he really has to, because we are facing unilateral disarmament across the board if we allow this sort of atrophying of our deterrent to continue. As you say, Bill, modernization has not been something we've done to speak of for decades, and it's high time that we get on with it. Speaking of which, Bill, let me just ask you, because again, you've been making book on this quite literally for years. Remind us of the role that Bill Clinton and the Loral Corporation played in helping the Chinese master the so-called MIRV technology, multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles of the kind that evidently is now being used on these DF-5C missiles.
Yeah, as part of an incredibly naive and damaging export policy under the Clinton administration in the late 90s, they increased space launcher cooperation between the U.S. and China with a number of companies. Loral Hughes was one, Motorola was another. And as part of that space launch cooperation, they've transferred strategic missile technology, including the capability to launch multiple satellites. Well, if you look at the technology there, there's very little difference between launching multiple satellites and launching multiple warheads. It's essentially the same. So in a large measure, the U.S. is to blame for failing to prevent the Chinese from developing multiple warhead technology. And that is can be traced right to the Clinton administration's naive policy about cooperating with Beijing on space launch cooperation.
Indeed. Bill, let me switch lastly to a piece that you ran in the Inside the Ring column this week about evidence the intelligence community has been picking up that Al-Qaeda is back in business. And what that means, Bill, for a policy that has been largely focused, in terms at least of the external jihadist threat, on the Islamic State.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember going back to 2012, we had President Obama proclaiming that Al-Qaeda was on the run.
On the path to defeat, to be precise.
Yeah, and now new intelligence has emerged that they have begun regrouping inside of Syria, a failed state, and were actually in the process of planning foreign attacks. That prompted a major U.S. bombing raid near Aleppo in Syria about 2 weeks ago, where we killed about 100 Al-Qaeda, not Islamic State, but Al-Qaeda. And there also was an additional raid we saw where we lost a Navy SEAL in Yemen. That was very successful in one sense in getting lots of electronic devices from Al-Qaeda, which is going to reveal a lot of their planning and operations. But clearly the Al-Qaeda threat is not over, despite what Obama has said about Al-Qaeda's decline many years ago.
Indeed. Bill, as always, your expertise and your coverage of these tremendously important problems, developments, and challenges is extraordinarily appreciated. I know you'll keep up the good work and come back to us again next week. In the meantime, thanks, my friend. We'll talk to you soon. Next up, Ted Brahman joins us from the American Enterprise Institute. We'll talk about the Trump-May relationship and that more straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Kyle Scheidler, one of my esteemed colleagues and an extraordinarily capable young man in the national security space. He runs the Threat Information Office at the Center for Security Policy. He formerly was the Director of Research and Communications at our highly regarded colleagues, Sarah Stern Endowment for the Middle East Truth. Kyle Scheidler, welcome back. It's good to have you, my friend.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Frank. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you about a topic that you've addressed recently at the Federalist, Kyle, and that is the question that is on a lot of people's minds at the moment, particularly critics of Donald Trump's executive order with respect to immigration, that there really hasn't been a problem with foreign immigrants and refugees in particular turning out to be jihadists. How would you describe the actual facts and how serious a problem does it actually represent?
Well, I think what's interesting about this is how sort of the left-wing think tanks and the journalists move the goalpost on what defines a terrorist act or what defines foreign terrorists. And so, as I wrote in the Federalist, we had a really perfect example of this when New York Times White House correspondent Maggie Haberman posed the question on Twitter, other than the San Bernardino attack, has there ever been a terrorist attack involving a non-U.S. born attacker since 9/11? And of course, anyone who has been awake for the past 15 years knows perfectly well that there has been. And Twitter very quickly reminded her of numerous attacks, including, of course, the Boston Marathon bombing, the Chattanooga Recruiting Center attack, the Ohio State University attack, and of course, there are numerous other examples. But this is an idea of how the left moves the goalpost by framing the question so that they get the answer that they want. A better example of this was from a CNN article where they said, since 9/11, there have been no refugees who have committed a fatal terror attack in the United States. And that it is a Clinton-esque quibble because, of course, we have, for example, the two Iraqi refugees from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Now, they did not commit an attack in the United States, although they were in the stages of preparing for one. But they did kill American soldiers overseas. You also have the Ohio State University individual I had mentioned before, who, although he ran several people over with a car and stabbed them, he wasn't successful in killing anyone. But they're able to manipulate the discussion by how they frame the language. You know, eventually we're going to move to the point where they will be telling us that there have been no attacks that killed anyone conducted by a refugee from Somalia on a Tuesday under a full moon.
That killed somebody, right? All of these caveats notwithstanding, we clearly have a problem. And I think that the reason that the public has overwhelmingly, it appears, supported Donald Trump's effort to stop importing jihadists is they just assume not take the chance, even if this had never been a problem to date. And you're right, Kyle Scheidler, of course it has been, that it will be a big problem in the future if we persist in the kind of policies that we've been pursuing. Let me ask you one question. I've been meaning to do this for some time, Kyle. With respect to many of the folks that you've just described, they've been, of course, when the law enforcement authorities finally belly up to the bar and say, well, yes, actually, they were terrorists or they were, you know, associated with sort of an Islamic State or other kind of Sharia supremacist ideology. That's not, of course, the word they use, but that's the one I think is appropriate. They've nonetheless insisted that they were lone wolves. Kyle, based on your study at the Threat Information Office of the Center for Security Policy, is it fair to say that most, if not virtually all of these characters have one thing in common, and that is that they have actually had some kind of association with a jihadist mosque in this country?
Well, this is one of the issues that we run into because essentially federal law enforcement really doesn't even ask this question. So they don't look into the question of what other associations an individual may have had that would fit the description that they use of extremist and we would use of jihadist or Sharia supremacist. And they don't really examine this. So, for example, I mentioned the Chattanooga Recruiting Center shooter. He had very close ties to a mosque in Tennessee that has ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. It was, in fact, founded and they fundraised on the notion that donating to that mosque was zakat eligible, zakat being the Islamic legal requirement to tithe part of one income.
Kind of a tax, actually, really. It's obligatory.
That's right. But they said that funding this mosque was zakat eligible because this mosque would meet the requirement for funding jihad.
Mm. They literally explicitly said that? Wow. Less explicit, but also proudly zakat eligible, is the Council on American Islamic Relations. And Kyle Scheidler, you recently did a superb job of helping to pull together materials that shed light on the genesis and true character of CARE. Talk a little bit about your new book on this subject and what lessons we should be taking away from it as a new administration tries to figure out what to say or do about organizations like CARE.
Well, one of the things about CARE that most people don't understand is that it was really born under a dark star, in that the FBI was literally surveilling members of what's described as the Palestine Committee. And the Palestine Committee was the organization of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States that had a responsibility to support Hamas. And at a meeting of the Palestine Committee in Philadelphia, they had a discussion of,
back in 1993.
That's correct. They had a discussion about founding a new organization that would assist them in lobbying the government and also engaging in media activities.
Political warfare and fundraising, right, as well.
That's correct. And that organization would become CARE. Now, that was the testimony not of Kyle Scheidler or Frank Gaffney, but of the FBI.
And so you have, as a result of what you've pulled together in this book, CARE is Hamas, how the federal government proved that indeed the Council on American Islamic Relations was a front for what is now a designated terrorist organization. It's really required reading, folks, and I can encourage you once again to check it out and all of the other books by Kyle Scheidler and others at the Center for Security Policy. And finally, Kyle, very quickly, one of the people who has long been associated with the Council on American Islamic Relations and indeed other Islamist and Muslim Brotherhood tied operations in the United States is Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota. He is campaigning hard to become the next chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and it constituted a bit of a shootout, I guess you'd say, in a figurative sense of the word, at a recent debate. Talk a little bit about what happened there.
Well, the DNC is currently looking for their next committee chairman, and there was a bit of a kerfuffle when Vincent Tolliver, who is a DNC activist out of Arkansas, wrote to The Hill saying that he didn't believe Keith Ellison should be eligible because of his Islamic faith and the positions that Islamic law has on homosexuality. So it's a very interesting sort of interscene conflict in the DNC, where you have a African-American Democrat speaking up on behalf of homosexuals and how homosexuals are treated under Islamic law, being essentially run out of the DNC chairmanship debate because he made these statements.
Wow. This is a backdrop for an issue we'll be following closely with your help at the Threat Information Office, Kyle, the prospects for the Democratic Party to make their chairman a known associate of and advocate for Sharia supremacism in the United States, Keith Ellison. Stay tuned for that and much more, folks. Kyle, I hope you'll come back to us soon and that the rest of you will do the same on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.